Welcome to this third edition of the Becoming Human in the Cosmos podcast, based on the book of the same title on Amazon. This podcast will center on the first part of the first chapter, titled The Eschatological Outlook, Think Like God, Part 1. Chapter 1, The Eschatological Outlook, Think Like God. Now, before we go any further, let's define eschatological as compared to scatological. Two words that sound very close to each other, scatological and eschatological. And yet, no two words could mean any more the opposite. The eschatological outlook, thinking like God, is the view of life that sees everything from an eternal perspective, from immortality, and does not dwell on the everyday thoughts and worries of our mortal life. That's the eschatological outlook. The scatological outlook is a division of science wherein, and there's no polite way to express this, they examine dinosaur turds. They go back and dig through piles and layers and stuff like that, and they come across a dinosaur turd, and they're quite happy. They have found something that contributes to their science, and it's a perfectly legitimate science. But we do not want to mix up eschatological, thinking like God, and scatological, looking for dinosaur turds. To begin the chapter, the meaning of earthly existence lies not, as we have grown used to thinking, in prospering, but in the development of the soul. And as I promised, that's Alexander Solzhenitsyn kicking off this book. It comes from his Gulag Archipelago, Volume 2, page 613. That's the theme of this book, in the words of a man I consider to be the greatest thinker and writer of the 20th century. As to what the soul is, what constitutes its development, the cosmic milieu in which it exists, and for what purposes it is to be developed, will be other themes dealt with as we go. As Solzhenitsyn, in pointing us to the meaning of earthly existence that lies beyond pecuniary interest, is expressing an eschatological outlook. To define it, last, uttermost, a body of teachings about last or final things as death, resurrection, judgment, the millennium, etc. The Winston Dictionary, College Edition, 1944. Yes, it's an old dictionary, but my grandmother Hornsby, who had a big hand in teaching me to read, gave it to me, and I wanted to honor her here and all adults who take time to teach children to read. You never can tell where your efforts will go. To go along with Solzhenitsyn's outlook, we also have the meaning given by Professor Hugh Nibley Opsit in his book Old Testament and Related Studies, pages 1 through 2. The eschatological viewpoint is that which sees and judges everything in terms of a great eternal plan. And whether we like it or not, we belong to the eternities. We cannot escape the universe. All our thoughts and deeds must be viewed against an infinite background and against no other. In the March 2012 issue of BYU's Humanities Magazine, they had this wonderful insight regarding seeing things through God's eyes. It happened that a rabbi and some students were looking down at their Russian village from a hilltop, when some Cossacks rode in and began slaughtering innocent and unarmed women and children. The rabbi looked to heaven and sighed, "If only I were God." The students asked him what he'd do different if he were God. The rabbi said, "If I were God, I would do nothing differently. But if I were God, I would understand." To come to think like God, to understand, is the goal of this chapter, indeed this book. Brigham Young, the Mormon pioneer and leader, said, "No one supposes for one moment that in heaven the angels are speculating, that they are building railroads and factories, taking advantage one of another, gathering up the substance there is in heaven to aggrandize themselves, and that they live on the same principles that we are in the habit of doing. No Christian, no sectarian Christian in the world believes this. They believe that the inhabitants of heaven live as a family, that their faith, interests, and pursuits have one end in view, the glory of God and their own salvation, that they may receive more and more. We all believe this, and suppose we go to work and imitate them as far as we can." Journal of Discourses, Volume 17, pages 117 through 118. It's hard to gain the eschatological outlook in a world that has nearly all priorities skew-hawed. Contrast these two scenarios. A rap singer glorifies the abuse of women, the use of drugs, and the killing of police officers. He gets paid in the hundreds of thousands of dollars for one night's performance. That same night, loving people caring for the elderly in a nursing home, for the retarded in a state home, nurses laboring with terminally ill children, or teachers working late to prepare next day's lessons get minimal wage or slightly more in the case of teachers and nurses. Those are the values of our world, or our capitalist society. We have it as backwards. It seems the psychologist Carl Jung has the same outlook. In his book, Man and His Symbols, Jung says, "Modern man does not understand how much his rationalism, which has destroyed his capacity to respond to numinous symbols and ideas, has put him at the mercy of the psychic underworld. He has freed himself from superstition, or so he believes, but in the process he has lost his spiritual values to a positively dangerous degree. His moral and spiritual tradition has disintegrated, and he is now paying the price for this breakup in worldwide disorientation and dissociation." Quote comes from my son Cody, who is reading the quoted source from his Kindle, so regrettably, I have no page number. Let me just make one observation to put this into the concrete from the abstract. We call ourselves a Christian nation, quote unquote. Compare the health care plan of Jesus Christ with our current health care plan. All who asked of him were healed, free of charge. In the United States, in contrast, we pay vast amounts for health insurance. Then when we need it, we're shunted off to a telephone answering service in India, where they find all sorts of loopholes and red tape in the contracts to deny us the health care we thought we were paying for. Could any two systems be any more opposite? How long can we call ourselves a Christian nation and let this totally alien to Christ form of health care prevail before God gets really upset with us for taking his name in vain? But I digress. The purpose of this book is not to change our political systems. I'm way too insignificant for that. I'll just stick with insights into the development of the individual soul, the meaning of life, and let it go at that. I do like what Winston Churchill is reported to have said regarding democracy. "It's the worst system imaginable, except for all the others." I'd say the same for capitalism, too. An extreme example of a non-eschatological outlook is this from Solzhenitsyn's description of a camp veteran at the concentration camp who gave him an introductory bit of advice upon his arrival. "A cruel and determined expression was the principal trait of this camp veteran's face and is the national hallmark of the Gulag Islanders." Those were the inmates in the prison camps. "From your very first step in camp, everyone will try to deceive and plunder you. Trust no one but yourself. Look around quickly. Someone may be sneaking up on you to bite you. The gulag functioned by the law of the jungle, and no justice was to be expected. No one ever does anything for nothing. No one ever does anything out of the generosity of his heart. You have to pay for everything. Previously cited, Gulag Archipelago, pages 563 through 64. And it's not to say that his advice is wrong. It probably contributes greatly to one's survival in such a situation. But is it a price one wants to pay? What of your soul, which shrivels and contracts under such a world outlook? And if you survive to be released from the camp, you don't leave this outlook at the gates. You take it with you into civilian and family life and are burdened with it for the rest of your mortal life unless you take strong and active steps to rid yourself of it. Well, easy for me to say. I've never been in that situation. This serves, of course, as a metaphor for the outlook we take into the eternities when we answer that call to go through the lighted tunnel and back to God. In contrast to this approach, Viktor Frankl's classic camp recollection, and Viktor Frankl, by the way, was a Jewish inmate in Auschwitz, and he wrote a book titled Man's Search for Meaning. And he remembers men who walked through the huts, comforting others, giving away their last piece of bread, and this in Auschwitz. Man's Search for Meaning, page 86. Howard Storm's near-death experience shows the eschatological outlook as taught him by his spirit guides. How you judge the outcome is not how things really are. You judge by appearances. That is not the reality of how things really are. You think wealth, possessions, physical attractiveness, and long life are success in life. They don't necessarily mean anything. Some of the people God has favored with the gifts of love, wisdom, joy, and hope never had wealth, power, and material things, physical beauty, or long lives. When God came into the world through Jesus, he had none of these things. They are insignificant compared to the spiritual growth of the soul. Life in the world is not about acquisitions, power, or pleasure. You are given a life in the world for only one purpose, which is to love God. You love God by learning God's will and doing God's will by loving one another. Anything else is immaterial to the purpose of your brief life experience in this world. That's Howard Storm's book, My Descent into Death, page 78. My favorite wordings of the eschatological outlook come in couplets. It's not that we are mortal beings having spiritual experiences, but rather spiritual beings having the mortal experience. And we do not see things as they really are. We see things as we really are. In an analysis of near-death experiences and the effects they had on those receiving them, authors Craig Lundahl and Harold Whittison summarized near-death researcher Raymond Moody's findings thus: NDEers, near-death experiencers, became more reflective and more concerned with philosophical issues. They had a heightened sense of appreciation for life and a determination to live life to the fullest with a renewed sense of purpose in living. And as a stronger person who values love and service to others and no longer feels that material comforts in life are so important, pages 18 through 19. Eschatology is learning to think like God, and that isn't easy. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, saith the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. Isaiah 55, 8 through 9. Until we see things through his eyes, much of what he does can seem contradictory or even downright evil. How many people are thrown off religion because of the vengeful God of the Old Testament killing or having killed millions of people? The flood of Noah is a major example. How many innocent children perished? Thousands at least. To get a handle on this as to Noah's flood, or indeed where all situations make us think God must be some kind of evildoer, I must resort to metaphor. Let's see if we can get ourselves to think like God. Imagine yourself as a parent of a rather promising child. He's gotten good grades in high school, good enough that he's granted admission to Harvard, though not a scholarship. Just think, 4 to 6 more years of parenting will have really paid off. You mortgage your home to pay for the first semester, $30,000 please, and send him off to Boston. A few weeks go by and you don't hear from him. You begin to be anxious. Then a letter comes from Harvard informing you that your son hasn't attended any of his classes, is flunking them all, and is on academic probation. Finally, you get hold of him, and he says, yes, he's been fooling around, but he can make it up. He promises to study, go to school, and get back on track. Then you begin to hear from his friends. He's drinking, taking drugs, partying night and day, and still not attending to his schoolwork. At the end of the semester, he's flunked every class and is about to be thrown out of rehab. He asks for more money to continue his education. Do you, as a parent, continue to subsidize this behavior? Or do you go back to Harvard, grab him by the shirt collar, drag him home, install him in McDonald's flipping burgers until he can pay off the $30,000 he squandered, and enroll him in the local community college so he can at least get a couple of years on his education? If choice number 2, then congratulations. You're thinking like God. How so? Just expand this to an eternal scale. This earth life is a school, and God expects us to learn and progress. If we fool our time away and refuse to come around, God, as our parent, has every right to bring us back home and straighten us out, just as you would do with your ne'er-do-well kid at Harvard. But you say, my kid is still alive. The people God killed are dead. No, they're not. We have to have our heads screwed on straight about this. No one has ever died. God has never killed anyone in the sense that they no longer exist as sentient entities in any form whatsoever. We are eternal, immortal spirits and cannot be brought to non-existence. Now, there may be an exception to that, which I'll discuss later, but in any event, it is not an act of God, but rather an act of our own volition, no context in which to discuss it here. We may be removed from one sphere of existence to another, such as this mortal world to the spirit world, but that is not death, as we usually think of it. Not true. The bodies of those drowned in Noah's flood are part of a fossil layer somewhere, but their spirit, the true life of the body, is very much alive and trying, in a place called a spirit prison, to get back on track. For references to spirit prison, see the New Testament, 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 18 through 20, and 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 6. These verses tell us that those who perished in the time of Noah's flood were given a second chance, taught by Jesus Christ after his death, so they could ultimately live according to God in the Spirit. If this is true for those drowned in Noah's time, then it must be true, to be fair, for the whole human race. God has a backup plan for Plan 1, which is to make wise and productive use of this mortal experience. Plan 2 is to pull us out of this school if we've shown we just can't put it to good use and set us in spirit prison, or reform school, if you will, to learn in that milieu, the parallel of which above is you bringing your child home from Harvard to go to community college. Now, this is not to say that all people who die young were goofing off in this life, not by any means. God has his plans and purposes for each one of his children. And, tragically to us, sometimes, it involves an early death. God does not just arbitrarily, eventually kill people on a whim when he's having a bad day. He acts as any good mortal parent would, only on a cosmic scale. Now, as to spirit prison, very quickly, we think of prison and we think of bars and chains and being locked in a cell. The near-death experiences of those who go to spirit prison describe it as a garden. It's a paradise, a place of freedom, a place of education and learning. It is no more a prison in our current thinking of the term prison than it is. It simply is not a prison as we would currently think of prison in our mortal experience. In many cases in the Old Testament, God acted to end a cycle of corruption and perversion which had devolved to child sacrifice. These highly offensive and immoral practices had to be brought to a halt, or every child God sent to this earth would have been in danger of having his life cut short by being thrown into a blazing hot furnace so Mom and Dad could have a good spring wheat crop. Those innocent children who perished in Noah's flood were brought back to loving arms in paradise, arms that would never throw them into a fire. A few moments of terror and pain, an eternity of being safe and free from the harms and dangers of an idolatrous society. If you still can't buy the reasoning here, a later chapter deals in greater depth with a similar scenario, the Holocaust. We're seeing if we can come around to God's way of thinking, or the ultimate example of the eschatological outlook. I find it helpful to put these things in parent-child relationships, and if we can learn to contemplate God in those terms, many of the mysteries and questions about him will be solved. Consider this ratio. We are to our children as God is to us. Now, in mathematics, using a ratio, you can compare things that are grossly dissimilar and make them equal. For example, 1 is to 10 as 1 trillion is to 10 trillion. Now, obviously, there's a much greater difference between 10 trillion and 1 trillion, and yet, as a ratio, they are equal. I consider this the grand key for understanding God, and I will refer to it often. The great ratio: we are to our children as God is to us. What is good parenting for us on a much larger scale and with an eschatological understanding is good parenting from God. Quick example. Would you, as a parent, have a stranger stick needles into your child and put poison and deadly germs into them? Sure you would. It's known as vaccination. Now blow that up to cosmic scale. Would God, as a loving parent, allow us to have pain, difficulty, and challenges? Sure, that's part of our education here. Example, my oldest boy, Corey, played Little League Baseball. He was pretty good at it, and when he was 10, he was accepted on a major league team comprised mainly of 11 to 12-year-olds. He was the youngest kid on the team and was warned that at that level, he'd probably be riding the bench a bit. Still, he was game and wanted to challenge himself, for which I was the proud and happy father. It so happened that year I wasn't coaching his team, but I went to his games and practices, observing from the bleachers and trying to keep my mouth shut. Hard for me to do. Anyway, in one batting practice, Corey was taking his turn against a kid that had a wicked fastball. No control. I know. Once I was standing about 20 feet from home plate, and he nailed me in the shin. I had a sore lump for 2 weeks. On a pitch, he hit my boy squarely in the back. I could hear the thump from clear up in the bleachers. Corey went down, writhing on the ground and fighting back tears. His coach came out and offered to let Corey sit down for a bit and work off the pain. Corey waved him off and went back in the batter's box to finish his turn and face that same pitcher. I was never more proud of my son. Now, I recently had a discussion with three mothers on the same situation. One of them was Corey's mother. And all three of these mothers said they would have come down off of that bench, gone out onto the field, and taken their boy out of that batting practice. And I asked them, do you realize what you would be losing and what he would be losing by those actions? you would be losing the privilege of seeing your little boy grow up to become a man in that moment. You would be taking that away from him. You would be losing that for yourselves. I couldn't convince them. All three mothers maintained they would go down and take him off the field. Well, the mother attachment to the child and the mother's love for a child is not to be trifled with, I agree. But still, let's blow that up to cosmos size again. We ask, why doesn't God do something? Why doesn't he help me or make us have world peace, etc., etc.? What would have been the consequences if I'd come down off those bleachers and taken Corey home to never have to face pain and trouble like that again? I would have humiliated him in the eyes of his peers. I would have made of him an emotionally crippled adult who would never face up to his trials and would always come running to Daddy to fix his problems. Not that he would have. I know Corey, and I'm sure he would have found ways to circumvent any helicopter parenting on my part, or his mother's part, too. Don't tell her I said that. Now, let's go to an example from the Old Testament. If we're going to learn to think like God, let's take the bull by the horns and find the most egregious examples we can. Imagine having 12 children. They've grown and live away from home, but you know of their activities, and further, you have a good rapport with local law enforcement. You have just been tipped off that an out-of-town drug gang has been ripped off by your kids, and they're coming for revenge. The upshot will be that one-third of your children will be murdered. One-third will be taken away into slavery and bondage. And one-third will be left in town, but still in slavery, to earn money for the drug gang. How bad would your children have to be for you to hold back and let all these things happen to them without your interference? Now let's go down the list of offenses as chronicled in Ezekiel chapter 16 in the Old Testament and see if there isn't a tipping point where you stand back and say, okay, these kids have it coming. I'm sorry, there's nothing I will do to help them. That is essentially what God said to Israel just before the sack of Jerusalem by the Babylonians around 590 B.C. It was an hellacious siege. The Israelites got so hungry they wound up eating their own children before Jerusalem finally fell and one-third died. One-third went to Babylon in slavery, and one-third stayed back to work the land and pay tribute to the Babylonians. Now, in Ezekiel chapter 16, God lists his reasons for being upset with his children. Verse 6, he basically picked them up as babies cast into a dumpster, for modern-day terminology. From there, he fed, cared for, and nursed them until they grew up, verses 7 through 14. However, like a beautiful but brainless nymphomaniac girl child, they gave their beauty out as sexual favors to anyone who asked for them, and took the wealth of clothing, food, jewels, and precious metals he had given them, made images of false gods, idols, and committed sexual perversions with them, verses 15 through 20. In fact, in playing the whore to every neighbor, they didn't even have sense enough to at least make a profit from their activities, but they paid their customers instead. Now, this isn't to sanction prostitution, but to point out how dumb they were. Even the sorriest of hookers on our city streets isn't about to hand out sex to her customers and them pay them as well. Verses 26 and 34. Yeah, you're probably not ready yet to give your children up to the drug gangs. But as the TV ad says, but wait, there's more. Then they take your grandchildren. I have five, and the love and joy that grandparents have for their grandkids knows no bounds. They take those innocent, loving babies and sacrifice them in a horrifying ritual involving throwing them screaming and crying into a huge furnace, so they can have success in business or in their crops or over their enemies. Verses 20 through 21. Now, are you ready to turn your kids over to the drug gangs and stand idly by while they suffer the punishments described above? No matter how much you love your children, does there not eventually come a point when you've had it and you figure there's nothing more you can do and you just wash your hands of them? We like to think of God as infinitely loving and patient, and He is. But He also has an obligation to the spirit children coming to earth to see to it that they arrive in a milieu that is at least somewhat conducive to their eternal growth and development, and that they won't be thrown into a furnace before they get any kind of real chance in life. Behold, the Lord hath created the earth that it should be inhabited, and He hath created His children that they should possess it. Book of Mormon, page 39. God has obligations not to just to us here on earth, but to those spirits waiting to come to earth. If a relatively safe atmosphere, conducive to learning, testing, and growth, can't be provided for them, then His plans for us are frustrated. If we on earth screw up either society or this planet, or both, so it can't be constructively inhabited, then all is for naught. We here on earth are not the only beings in the cosmos, and this earth is not just for us here and now, but for future generations. And there are times God has to remove large segments of us through war, disaster, or what have you, so those waiting can have their legitimate shot at life and its experiences. I'm stressing this because a lot of people simply can't buy the God concept because of the horror and bloodshed of the Old Testament. It has to be understood, taken in context. We have to learn to think like God and not cling to the warm, fuzzy concepts taught by many religions today simply because they make us feel good. There is a blood and guts reality to the cosmos, and until we recognize and reconcile ourselves to it, we won't be one with God. Another look. If you had a family of 10 children, and a couple of the older kids dropped out of school, got into drugs, pornography, and were starting to molest their younger siblings, would you let them stay in your home? If you're any kind of a loving, responsible parent, you'd have to throw them out for the safety and welfare of the younger children. That's not far different from the choices God had to make regarding His children. Remember, there was a war in heaven, and Lucifer and one-third of the host of heaven were evicted. Revelation chapter 12, verses 7 through 9. It's not easy being God, and we don't make it any easier on Him when we judge Him from our ignorant and extremely limited mortal point of view. God has His children, and He has special groups of children from whom He expects special works. The tribes of Israel are an example. It was the calling of the Israelites to bring ethical monotheism to the world, as any Navy SEAL is set apart and undergoes much more rigorous training than the average sailor. So the Israelites were to be set apart and special from the rest of the human race. It's not that God loves them more, no more than the president, its commander-in-chief, loves the SEALs more than the regular sailors. It's just that more is expected of the SEALs than the average sailor. Therefore, the SEALs have more rules, more training, more preparation than the regular Navy personnel. And some of these rules would seem to us silly. For example, on their dress uniforms, the SEALs have to be sure that their shirt buttons line up in a straight line with their belt buckles and flies. If a straight line can't be drawn down their midsection connecting these three clothing accessories, then they're in for punishment. We may think that's a bit silly. What does that have to do with wiping out the enemy? Plenty, actually. They're being trained to be scrupulous regarding details. It's a biblical principle. If we're faithful in small things, we'll be made ruler over big things. Matthew 25 and 21. In a short while, these SEAL trainees will be working with things that explode and kill people. If they aren't meticulous in handling them, they and those around them could be killed. Where do they learn that care and precision? In basic training, with things that don't explode, such as shirt buttons, belt buckles, and flies. But if they get these things right, then they can be trusted with the more serious items of warfare. And thus it was with the house of Israel. Through strict observance of the laws of Moses, many of which seemed to us silly, Israel was being trained and educated by God for serious spiritual duties on this planet. It's not that it matters whether you eat pork or not. It matters whether or not one can take God seriously and be obedient in the small things in preparation for the big things. They were learning discipline. Again, think like God, and you'll see good reasons for much of what seems either bloody, arbitrarily, or evilly whimsical in the Old Testament. There is an eternal context in which our relationship to God must be put if we are to understand completely what is going on with us and deity. This is a context taught by no other religion, theology, or philosophy that I know of, save the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and one which may well be a breaking point for most listeners. But if I didn't introduce it here, I'd be shortchanging you and leaving out a context which I believe is essential for our understanding of God. The context is this, to repeat the prologue: God did not create us. We are co-eternal with Him. True, He did create our spirit and mortal bodies, but the true life that is us, that cannot die or be killed, that inhabits these tabernacles, is co-eternal with God, meaning neither He nor we had a beginning, and in that sense, and only in that sense, are we equal. It is called in the LDS religion intelligence. As to what it actually is, I have no idea. Energy, waves, thought, potential, idea, a quanta, as in the smallest possible theoretical unit of energy, I haven't the faintest. The only difference between us and Him is that He's farther down the line of human development than we are, and He is loving enough, generous and magnanimous enough, to look back and give us encouragement and help in catching up to where He is. I guess I should leave a note by my editor, if I ever have one, to leave space in the margin here for readers to write in large letters, "Blasphemy." Be that as it may. Joseph Smith, Mormonism's founder, put it this way in a famous funeral oration known as the King Follett Sermon. Speaking of God creating man in the original Hebrew version of Genesis, he says, "We say that God Himself is a self-existent being. Who told you that man did not exist in like manner upon the same principles? Man does exist upon the same principles." It does not say in the Hebrew that God created the spirit of man. It says God made man out of the earth and put into him Adam's spirit, and so became a living body. The mind or the intelligence which man possesses is co-eternal with God Himself. Teachings of the Prophet Joseph Smith, pages 352 to 354. Intelligence is eternal and exists upon a self-existent principle. It is a spirit from age to age, and there is no creation about it. In a book written to celebrate the bicentennial of Joseph Smith's birth, Joseph Smith, Rough Stone Rolling, author Richard Lyman Bushman elaborates on the above as he deals with the King Follett sermon. God was one of the free intelligences who had learned to become God. The other free intelligence were to take the same path by going from small degree to another, from exaltation to exaltation. Christ was the model that made individual persons radically free. Their nature was not predetermined by their Creator. They were what they were, not what God made them. Rather than God being the sovereign creator of all things from nothing, He was the most intelligent of the free intelligences. The universe is a school for these free, self-existing intelligences. Pages 534 through 535. that God refuses absolutely to interfere with our freedom or personality is also the subject of a later chapter, and also covered in the prologue. But another consideration we must have in learning to think like Him. And this is also an important concept for us to hold on to as we try to think like God. He respects our independence and equality in this way. We are fellow travelers in this cosmos, and part of us at least have the same destination in mind, the full realization of our human potential. For intelligences who don't want to take their existence all the way, God respects their choices in that and will safeguard them and help them rise as high as they desire. More on that later. Continuing now with a more mundane, but I think important aspect of the eschatological outlook. Among other things, we try to balance the material aspects of this world with the eternal. Please note, I'm not advocating becoming a fasting and starving monk dressed in rags. This temporal, mortal life is a gift from God, and He expects us to make wise use of it. Aristotle expressed it best in his Golden Mean, though he didn't name it that. The name came later. But he tried to define the right area between such wrongs as foolhardiness on one end of the scale and cowardice on the other. The proper mean would be courage. Historian Will Durant gets the following from Aristotle's Ethics, wherein Aristotle said, "The qualities of character can be arranged in triads, in each of which the first and last qualities will be extremes and vices." Remember, the Greeks classically said nothing in the extreme. "And the middle quality is a virtue or an excellence. So between cowardice and rashness is courage. Between stinginess and extravagance is liberality. Between sloth and greed is ambition. Between humility and pride is modesty. Between secrecy and loquacity, honesty. Between moroseness and buffoonery, good humor. Between quarrelsomeness and flattery, friendship. Between Hamlet's indecisiveness and Quixote's impulsiveness is self-control." The Story of Philosophy, Will Durant, pages 75 through 77. Aristotle wouldn't have been quoting Hamlet and Quixote, of course. This is probably Durant's interpretation. A favorite definition: courage is walking naked through a cannibal village. Foolhardiness is walking naked through a cannibal village with a sprig of parsley tucked behind your ear. Be brave, but don't push your luck. Balance. And that word balance is going to come up again and again throughout this book. It's interesting to see this philosophy come up in different cultures of the world. The Buddhists have their middle road, the Taoists their yin and yang. The greatest thinkers of all cultures have always realized that balance, not excess, is the key to a workable mortal life. Too bad we can't have more of that in Congress and the political world in general, where compromise is considered weakness, and the only victory is one wherein an advocate for a certain side gets his way completely, plus his opponent is totally vanquished. These winner-take-all outlooks are doing great harm to our political process and our society. The Constitution was referred to as a bundle of compromises, which indeed it was, and had to be, to get this diverse nation up and running. Where is that spirit today? The key is balance. The Greek philosopher Plato had this version of an eschatological outlook known as Plato's Cave. Though the setup to me seems somewhat contrived and artificial, we must move beyond that to see the great insight it offers. In it, he pictures a group of people chained all their lives in a cave, in which their only view is of shadows on a wall created by a fire from outside. Remember, he's not coming from an electronic age. Fire was their only light. The images of shadow are the only reality these viewers know. one manages to escape this imprisonment, go outside and see the true forms of things, the reality. He comes back to his fellows in the cave and tries to convince them that the shadows they see on the wall are only semblances of a much more solid, truer, but external reality. The point Plato was making was that our earth life is extremely limited in vision and knowledge. We see only shadows of what are true eternal forms. Relying only on our senses, in this case our sense of sight, gives us but a limited view of the true and eternal realities. Those who escape, find the truth, and come back to us, we would call them prophets or near-death experiencers, have a much better take on ultimate and total reality than do we residents of the cave. We must ask ourselves, therefore, are we going to limit our thinking and vision to the shadows on the wall? Read that TV if you'd like. Or are we going to seek the broader, more comprehensive view reported by the returned escapee? In Black Elk Speaks, the life story of Black Elk, an Oglala Sioux holy man, I find the same thing. Black Elk lived in the late 19th, early 20th century Dakotas. Where would he have ever come across Plato's cave? To quote page 83, Crazy Horse dreamed and went into the world where there is nothing but the spirits of all things. That is the real world that is behind this one, and everything we see here is something like a shadow from that world. Interesting to find such corroboration across 2,300 years and two continents. From Emanuel Swedenborg's book, Conversations with Angels, What Swedenborg Heard in Heaven, I find this. Apparently Swedenborg could dial up the equivalent of a near-death experience almost at will. I am well aware that many will say that no one can possibly speak with spirits and angels as long as he lives in the body, and many will say that it is all imagination. But by all this I am not deterred, for I have seen, I have heard, I have felt, page 3. At the end of the work is this quote from him, I foresee that many who read the narratives will believe them to be inventions of the imagination, but I affirm in truth that they are not inventions, but were truly seen and heard, not seen and heard in any sleeping state of mind, but in a state of full wakefulness. The visible world, the world of apparent realities that are perceptible to the senses, is a representation of the spiritual, Plato's cave. They are symbolic of a higher order of reality. The spiritual world is the cause and the material world the effect. Swedenborg, pages 9 through 10. Plato's cave, 2,000 years after Plato and a couple hundred years before Black Elk. To sum up, then, the eschatological outlook and thinking like God, quoting again Joseph Smith from his teachings, pages 343, 354, there are but very few human beings in the world who understand rightly the character of God. If a man learns nothing more than to eat, drink, and sleep, and does not comprehend any of the designs of God, the beast comprehends the same things. If men do not comprehend the character of God, they do not comprehend themselves. The relationship we have with God places us in a situation to advance in knowledge. All things whatsoever God in his infinite wisdom has seen fit and proper to reveal to us are revealed in the abstract, independent of the affinity of this mortal tabernacle, but are revealed to our spirits precisely as though we had no bodies at all. And those revelations which will save our spirits will save our bodies. The New Testament says, and this is life eternal, that they might know thee, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom thou hast sent, John 17 and 3. Our understanding of God and being able to think like him is a matter, literally, of life, eternal life, or not. Therefore, I can't stress too greatly the importance of the eschatological outlook. And thus we conclude this third podcast of the series, Becoming Human in the Cosmos, based on the book I have on Amazon. The next podcast will be titled The Eschatological Outlook, Think Like God, Part 2, and it will deal with metaphors for life, so we can get a better understanding on this mortal experience. Join me, please, and thanks for tuning in, and special thanks to Craig Whitmore, my technical guy.